The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning for Father's Day is Bruce Feiler, author of Walking the Bible, who has a recent book out called The Council of Dads. We'll also have a visit from our Mevina on Jewish Ethics, Amy Hirschberg Letterman, storyteller Jordan Hill, and our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I've just returned from a family vacation that spanned various parts of the United States, including Washington, D.C. It was a very nice vacation. Thanks for asking. More on that later. But as always, seeing and hearing what other people are doing and thinking in other parts of the country helps lend perspective that you just can't get sitting at home, not even surfing the internet. Anyway, having been away for a little, this is kind of a catch-up day for me on Too Jewish, on some issues that have been percolating for a little while and which I haven't really been able to address fully. The first is the so-called flotilla incident on the last day of May, the 31st, when Israeli naval ships stopped a group of ships coming from Turkey that intended to break the Israeli embargo on goods being brought into the Gaza Strip. As you no doubt know, one ship called the Mavi Marmara, owned by an Islamist group and fitted out for this purpose in Turkey, refused to stop. Israeli commandos boarded it and stopped it, but a violent clash erupted. It left 9 Mavi Marmara occupants dead, perhaps a couple of dozen wounded, and 7 Israeli soldiers hospitalized with serious injuries. Well, while we have covered this incident to some degree on Too Jewish, after 3 weeks of huge media attention, if not for the BP oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, I think this would have been the number one news story for the month of June, it's time to get a little perspective on this unfortunate story. First, it's clear that the flotilla incident, calling a group of small ships smuggling stuff into an interdicted terrorist area flotilla is ridiculous, of course. This is not the Spanish Armada, for Pete's sake, or Dunkirk, or the D-Day landings at Normandy. But anyway, this flotilla has been a public relations disaster for Israel. While there are many important reasons Israel has the right and responsibility to prevent arms and even food or medical materials from being landed in Gaza without inspection, after all, this is a terrorist regime intent on making war with what it calls a Zionist entity or the eternal enemy or some such. It would have been far less expensive in every sense for Israel to have just let the jerks land their stuff in Gaza and then not have to deal with the international fallout for a violent confrontation with perfectly scripted martyrs. I'm not saying that this would have been the best course, just stating the simple fact that this has been a colossal mess for Israel, and that it probably didn't have to be. The best way to respond to a publicity stunt like this would have been to stop it without violence. Unfortunately, the IDF, the Israeli military, was not well prepared, and it handled a challenging situation on the whole unsuccessfully. Look, clearly the purpose of this guerrilla theater venture was to make Israel look very bad, and it worked. The amount of stuff these PR hounds were actually going to bring into Gaza would have had minimal impact on the horrendous self-inflicted condition of that territory, either economically or militarily. Basically, the Israeli military and the leadership in Israel, well, blew it. And they gave these jerks the platform they craved to attack Israel and to try to take the pressure off of Gaza and Hamas. Now, having said all of that, the truth is that the Mavi Marmara flotilla had no legal right to try to land in Gaza, that her passengers were seeking violent confrontation. 7 well-armed and trained Israeli commandos now lie in the hospital, and that doesn't happen when they confront a cooperative group of peaceful activists, does it? and that the motivation of the Mavi Marmara was to help Hamas by embarrassing Israel and forcing Egypt to open its borders and allow the free flow of food and other supplies. Now, this stunt didn't work exactly as expected. Egypt has been very slow to open its big borders with Hamas-run Gaza, but it has surely caused Israel a huge PR problem just when the Obama administration was trying to warm up relations and really bend over backwards to make up for early missteps. The other painful fact that emerged from this mess is that Turkey, long a strong ally of Israel in the Middle East, allowed and probably encouraged this maritime venture. That's not at all good news for Israel, even given the Islamist trend of the current regime in Turkey. Israel does not want Turkey as an enemy, but a friend. You know, I still think the Mavi Marmara incident will fade. In fact, it's already fading. And it will join the ranks of other agitprop efforts by Israel's enemies to humiliate her. This is not Kent State or some lasting issue that will change policy or alliances or borders. But it should lead to some close examination by both Israel's military and her policymakers on what would have been a better course of action to follow to avoid this kind of mess, because bad press is not something that goes away instantly. This flotilla thing will come back in international legal circles, make no mistake, and who knows where else. It is not just a sea story, and it certainly makes peace harder to envision.
ברוך הבא לנוח על חופיי לו הייתי ירוק בים הייתי אוהבת אותך בחינם ממרחקים תבוא
That was a bit of Yehonatan Geffen's Israeli song about a peaceful island in the sea. May it come to pass. So while traveling, I had the chance to see some newspapers I don't usually read, including the LA Times and the Washington Post, and to peruse the print version of the New York Times, which I usually just look at online. I was struck by the casual way all three papers of record in America treat news about Israel as a kind of confirmation of the bad opinion they already hold towards her. You know the script. More violent oppression from the Jewish state towards her beaten-down Palestinian victims, more international condemnation in the face of Israeli denial, and, you know, so on. Never mind the reality of the situation is almost diametrically opposed to those kinds of observations. Look, all you have to do is go to Israel to see that things are nothing like the press says they are. But the very freedom that opinion-making papers feel to use essentially hostile language about Israel is deeply disturbing. I must say that European papers are much worse than American ones, but that doesn't make it better. Whatever journalistic objectivity existed at times in the past where Israel is concerned is pretty far gone today. If you want some level of balanced reporting on Israel in a daily paper, you pretty much have to read the dumbed-down news like, you know, USA Today. I'm not sure that the Fox News approach is any better. Israel is always right, and the Arabs are all evil terrorists. But I'm beginning to think it helps balance things out a bit. Yeesh. Makes you long for a free and open press that intelligently spans the spectrum of debate about issues, events, and policies in a vigorous but fair way. You know, a press like Israel's. When we come back on Too Jewish This Morning, our guest will be Walking the Bible author Bruce Feiler, who experienced a life-changing illness and responded in a way that was incredibly inspirational and can teach us what being a father is all about. Meet him on Father's Day when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Chardonnay Shabbat is here. Friday night services were never this fun before. It's a loaf of good bread, a jug of excellent wine, and you, and a delightful way to begin your weekend with Sabbath fun and friendship at Temple Emmanuel during our summer Chardonnay Shabbat evenings. Join us for Chardonnay Shabbat at Temple Emmanuel every Friday night this summer. We start with a wine, cheese, and fruit pre-owned egg Shabbat reception at 5 p.m., followed by a fun, musical one-hour Sabbath service at 5:45. Celebrate summer with Chardonnay Shabbat. There's no charge or obligation. Just a lovely way to begin the weekend at Temple Emmanuel. Temple Emmanuel is centrally located at 225 North Country Club Road between Broadway and 5th. Call 520-327-4501 for more information. That's 327-4501. Or visit our website at templeemmanueltucson.org and join us on Friday nights for Chardonnay Shabbat.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish author Bruce Feiler. He's the New York Times best-selling author of 9 books, including Walking the Bible. We've had him here on Two Jewish talking about just that, Abraham, America's Prophet, and The Council of Dads. He is an award-winning author, journalist, speaker. The Walking the Bible book was turned into a award-winning PBS documentary series called I Know This Will Shock You, Walking the Bible. And an underachiever, he's a graduate of both Yale and Cambridge. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning. It's so nice to be with you.
Great to have you back. You know, The Council of Dads was probably not a book you planned to write. Just tell our listeners about how it came to be.
Well, yes, I'm afraid I was cursed with good material in the... In the most desperate week of my life, I came up with what may be the most hopeful idea I've ever had. In the summer of 2008, you mentioned America's Prophet, my book about Moses. I had just turned it in and was beginning to work on another project. And a routine blood test produced an accidental discovery that I had a 7-inch cancerous tumor in my left femur. So suddenly, you mentioned walking the Bible several times. Suddenly, I was the walking guy who might never walk again. And that discovery kind of launched me down a very long, dim journey. I had a very rare, aggressive form of bone cancer. And I went through a series of emotions in those first days. I thought, you know what? I'm at peace with myself. I have traveled the world. I've written books. I'm at peace with the decisions I've made in my life. And I also thought that my wife would be fine, that she'd find a way to live a life of passion because it's who she is at her core. But we were the parents at the time of 3-year-old identical twin daughters, and basically as any person would, I thought of all the things that I might miss, the art projects I wouldn't mess up, the boyfriends I wouldn't scowl at, the aisles I wouldn't walk down, and it was very hard. And I just kind of wondered, would they lack for my voice in some kind of core way in their life? And 3 days later, you don't really sleep when you first get learn you're sick in that way. I woke up, so to speak, with an idea of how I might give them that voice. I would reach out to men from all parts of my life and ask them to form a council of dads to father my potentially fatherless daughters. And so the core idea was that I would basically take these men. It ended up being my oldest friend, my camp counselor, my college roommate, my closest confidant, and a tortured romantic poet friend who's from New Mexico. And I basically asked each of them to represent a different side of me and to kind of convey different lessons, how to live, how to think, how to travel, how to dream. And I sat down with each one and asked them basically for one piece of advice they would give to my girls. And so all of that became the mix for the book, The Council of Dads. And my initial idea was basically just to live long enough to assemble the council, then to write the book, and now here I am publishing the book. And just the fact that it exists and it's created this sort of new community in our lives, it's just been a wonderful experience on almost every level.
Now, no one would wish cancer on you. We'll keep it in suspense till a little later in the show, but I think what's extraordinary about the book is you know clearly as you write this, you assume you're going to die.
Mm.
And
I've spent it's been almost 2 years now. I've spent basically a fair bit of every day thinking about dying.
It's a very powerful story, and yet a remarkably entertaining book. We will talk some more with Bruce Feiler, author of The Council of Dads, and, of course, Walking the Bible and many other books when we come back this morning on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of all past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there or at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. It's Father's Day today, so here's a classic Yiddish song to Dad, an interesting pop jazzy version of O Mein Papa, which Eddie Fisher made famous a long time ago as sung by Eleanor Risa.
O Mein Papa, er ist gewein mein Malachon.
Oh, my papa, a Yiddish classic. You know, fathers are important in all cultures, but for Jews, the concept of the father has extra importance. For example, the beginning of the central prayer in every service is called Avot, the prayer for the fathers, and it includes a text that praises God for being the God of our fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. From the time of the Talmud, at least 1,600 years ago, every Jewish prayer service has included this central evocation of Dad. Fathers are given special honor in other ways in Judaism. The Ten Commandments focus on honoring father and mother. The Gemara spends time debating whether the honor due your father is greater than the honor due to your teacher. You know, I remember raising that question at a temple retreat on ethics, explaining that teachers, including but not limited to rabbis, are supposed to be shown great honor at all times, and so are fathers. So whom should you honor more, your father or your rabbi? I asked. And my 7-year-old son, well, he was then 7, he's now 14, Boaz, raised his hand. I called on him to analyze this complex ethical question. Which do you favor, your father or your rabbi? What if your father is also your rabbi, he asked. Ending that discussion, as everybody dissolved. We hear a lot about Jewish mothers in our culture, but not so much about Jewish fathers. Perhaps that's a mistake. You know the famous joke? A boy comes home from school and says, Mom, I got cast in a school play. What's your part, she asks. I'm the Jewish father, she answers. You go back and tell the teacher you want a speaking part, says Mom. Well, that's not really how it works. In truth, fathers play a central role in teaching both sons and daughters about Judaism and morality, making the great traditions of our people meaningful and fresh in this and every generation. It's both the place of the father and his responsibility. And that's a very important part in any and every family, every mishpacha. So, happy Father's Day. And may all you fathers out there get just what you want from your kids today, which for most of us is not a tangible gift at all. It is their love, and, at least most of the time, their respect. We welcome our expert on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Lederman. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And this sounds weird. Happy Father's Day?
I am very happy to wish Ray, the father of Josh and Lauren, a happy Father's Day, and you as well.
Thank you. You know, Father's Day is sort of a hallmark holiday. I mean, you know, it's not really a Jewish holiday. It doesn't even have, you know, its biggest source is somebody wanted to sell greeting cards. But, you know, still.
You know what? I'm going to challenge on that, Father Rabbi.
That sounds kind of Catholic.
It does. I should have made a slash or hyphen between that.
Yes.
Because I think it's a very Jewish, I mean, okay, granted, the cards and the pancake breakfast at preschool, maybe not. But the reason that we honor our parents and our grandparents is no great mystery in Judaism. It's because these are the people who gave us life. And, you know, when you look at it, the most basic idea is that the Jewish tradition teaches that there are three partners in the creation of a human being: God, the father, and the mother. And so to have a holiday, we certainly have plenty of holidays that celebrate God. It doesn't surprise me that we would be able to embrace Mother's Day, Father's Day, Grandparents' Day as part of a holy relationship that we feel with our creators, with the people who, you know, really have given us life. And in the Jewish tradition, when we love and honor our parents, it's tantamount to loving and honoring God. It's really like a litmus test. So
I'll have to tell my kids that.
I know. It is one of the best kept secrets, especially amongst teenagers.
The truth is
that, you know, there's really something pretty remarkable to this notion, the fifth commandment, of both honoring our parents and then, of course, later on, revering our parents. And I want to take a different tack on this, though. I, as an adult, well, at least as an adult
chronologically,
wannabe, right? As an adult wannabe, I have found that something more recent in my life really challenged me in the last decade or so was honoring my parents in a way that let me become more authentic in my own life. And I think as kids, it's really easy to understand what honoring your parents means. We know it's not to, you know, talk back. It's not to do something that's really totally disrespectful. It's not to steal or do things that are really, you know, anathema to living an ethical life in the home. But as adults, while it may also include all of those things, I think that the notion of honoring your parents has to take it a step beyond, and that would include believing that your parents will be able to accept you as an adult, even if your choices are not what your parents perhaps wanted, hoped, or expected of you. And I think that's a really hard one for many adults to put their arms around. The notion that, you know, if we don't believe in our parents enough to think that they will accept and love us, if we choose different paths, if we have a career that's not as elaborate or professional as, you know, being a doctor, a lawyer, or accountant, if we have a sexual orientation that's not heterosexual, if we choose to live in a place that's not a typical community that they would feel comfortable with in a, you know, a suburban setting, we have to be able to understand that honoring your parents means that you would trust them enough to believe that they could respect the child that they raised and the choices that that child's made. So that to me is another angle. I don't think you can believe in yourself fully until you believe that your parents who gave you life can believe in you. And I think many adults don't make the choices that they may inevitably want to make, or don't tell their parents the truth about their lives, which is far worse, because they're concerned that their parents won't accept or believe in them. So I think that's a different, that's what I'd like to leave our listeners with this Father's Day, is to believe in your parents as much as you hope that they would believe in you.
It's a great lesson. Thanks, Amy. We'll talk next week.
Okay.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, from Two Jewish Storyteller Jordan Hill, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with a great restaurateur, Janos Weidler of Janos Restaurant and the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So what's going on this summer at Janos and the J-Bar?
We've got so much going on, it's hard for me to keep it all straight, but I'm going to try. We've got our summer music series that you know about. We have our summer passports where you dine, and the more times you dine, you collect stamps for free dinners at Janos or J-Bar. Our Janos summer samplers at $19.95, our J-Bar summer samplers at $12.95. At Janos, our 10 terrific taste menu, four courses, 12 different items for $50, drink specials, wine specials. Summer's our time.
I'm starving.
Well, come on over, Rabbi.
What's the phone number for Janos and the J-Bar?
615-6100.
And the website?
www.janos.com. We've got all our menus up. We've got the summer music schedule up.
And don't forget all the great samplers. We will see you at Janos and the J-Bar, J-A-N-O-S.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, we've had a wonderful journey to Italy over the last few weeks, talking about different Jewish sites from the north headed towards the south. I have never been to Sicily, but it has also an ancient and interesting Jewish heritage. Let's talk about Sicily.
Okay, with great pleasure. First of all, Sicily is absolutely gorgeous. I think it has, for my tastes, the best food in Italy. It's more vegetable and fish-oriented than any place else in the country, because traditionally, meat was hard to come by there. It was very expensive. It was only for the aristocrats. So they developed a whole cuisine based on local produce, which includes the fish that are so abundant in the waters which surround Sicily. Sicilians consider themselves to be from another country. When they talk about going to the mainland, they say, we're going to go to Italy. And actually, historically, Sicily was referred to as Magna Graecia, Greater Greece, because it was an important part of the sort of archipelago of Greek islands. And it's filled with actually more Greek ruins than Roman ruins. Beautiful amphitheaters, temples, whatever. I mean, the Selinunte, Segesta, the Agrigento, Taormina, the most famous view of all of Sicily on all the tourist posters is the amphitheater at Taormina. And there's one hotel you can stay at that's like right at the entrance to this amphitheater. I mean, it's literally less than a 2-minute walk, and it's all gorgeous. In terms of Jewish history of Sicily, one has to remember that Sicily was almost always a separate entity politically from whatever was happening on the mainland. And the mainland, as we've already emphasized, wasn't Italy for most of its history. But Palermo, which was usually the capital of Sicily, and certainly was so under the Norman rulers. And the Normans have left a genetic imprint on Sicily in the sense that there are a lot of Sicilians who don't look anything like the stereotype of sort of short, dark people with dark hair. And there are a lot of Sicilians who have blonde hair, blue eyes, and are quite tall. And in fact, recently, this just reminds me of a story. I was in Rome, and I had a taxi driver who seemed tall and had blue eyes. And I said, "Are you from Sicily?" He said, "Yeah, how'd you know?" I said, "Is your name Ruggero?" Which is Italian for Roger, right? Which was a common Norman name. He said, "Yeah, do you know me?" I mean, it was an amazing conversation. Anyway, we talked about like Sicilian cuisine and whatever. And the interesting thing in Palermo, which was the seat of government and the seat of Norman rulers, and then also at one point of Arab Muslim rulers who conquered Sicily and had a thriving Jewish community under them. In the 10th and 11th centuries, around the time of the Crusades, Palermo was a site of convivencia, the sort of happy coexistence, cohabitation of Jews, Muslims, and Christians. And recently, on maybe the 1,000th anniversary of something, the mayor of Palermo installed street signs in the old town of Palermo that are in Arabic, Hebrew, and Italian. So there's three alphabets reflecting the three cultures that once thrived together in Palermo. So that alone, I think, is worth a trip to Palermo just to see those street signs.
You know, it's such an interesting and complex history. After all, I've always wondered how it was that the Normans, who are basically Vikings and come, you know, means Northmen, came somehow down from Scandinavia, skirting the coasts, end up taking like Normandy in France, and then end up, you know, in Sicily, you know, off the end of the boot of Italy.
Well, it was those 200 years in Normandy that transformed them from being Vikings to being Normans. It made them Catholics.
Right.
It made them speak a Latin-based language, and it made them into imperialists.
As opposed to just raiders.
Exactly. Right? And they built an empire.
They built an empire, and Jews lived there and enjoyed it and enjoyed the fruits. Thanks, Tom, for that great tour, and we will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service, especially for Father's Day. Moshe turns 16 and receives his brand new driver's license. The family comes out to the driveway and climbs in the car. He's going to take him for a spin for the first time as driver. Dad immediately heads for the back seat, directly behind the newly minted driver, Moshe. "I bet you're back there to get a change of scenery after all those months sitting in the front seat teaching me how to drive," says Moshe to his dad. "Nope," comes Dad's reply. "I'm going to sit here and kick the back of your seat while you drive, just like you did to me all these years." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, especially for fathers. Special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Too Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Rabbi. So today's Father's Day, and I've got a father story, but even more importantly, in this case, a very clever rabbi story, a wise rabbi story. This one coming from the great rabbi, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. "Once upon a time, there was a very concerned father, and he was so concerned because his son had recently stripped down all of his clothes and was sitting naked underneath a table, refusing to come and sit at the table during dinner time or really at any other time. And when asked what the problem was, the son would say, 'Rock, rock, I'm a chicken. I'm not your son. I'm a chicken.' And the father was at his wit's end. He did not know what to do. The son just insisted on sitting there eating crumbs off of the floor and would do nothing else. And he had called in healers and wise men and wise women, and no one could help. Until one day, the rabbi showed up at his house, and the rabbi said, 'I think I can be of service, but you must bear with me, okay?' And the father said, 'Of course, anything for my son.' And the rabbi said, 'I'm going to take all my clothes off, and I want you to keep them until I beckon you and inform you to bring me something.' So the rabbi himself, he stripped down and he got under the table with that boy. And the boy looked at him in surprise and he said, 'Who are you?' And the rabbi said, 'I'm a chicken, like you.' And the boy said, 'Really?' And, well, the rabbi, he said, of course, and he stayed there, day after day after day with the boy, picking crumbs off the ground until soon the boy was clear that this guy was clearly another chicken. And they got comfortable with each other. And so comfortable that one day the rabbi looked at the boy and he said, you know what? It's a little bit chilly in here. I don't see if there's anything wrong with me putting a shirt on. I mean, I am a chicken, right? And the boy said, oh, yeah, you're definitely a chicken. He said, I'm still a chicken if I'm wearing a shirt, right? And the boy said, oh, yeah, I think so. So the rabbi put on his shirt and summoned the father over, and the father brought a shirt for the son, and the son put on the shirt, and he said, look, we're smart chickens because we can be so comfortable. And well, they sat there with their shirts on, pecking at the ground, until finally one day the rabbi called over to the father and said, you know what? Bring us our pants. And the same dialogue happened, and the boy finally agreed that you could still be a chicken and wear pants. After all, it was a smart thing to do as far as being a chicken went. And so there they were, comfortable enough, but as they were sitting there eating the crumbs off the ground, the delicious smells that were being cooked from the kitchen, well, the rabbi looked at the boy and said, why do we have to be so silly? I mean, we deserve as good food as the humans get, don't we? The boy said, yeah, I figure so. So the rabbi called to the father, and the father brought them both a plate of freshly cooked food. And the rabbi said, I'm still a chicken, right? And the boy said, yeah, I think so. And the rabbi, well, and the boy, they ate that food, and it was delicious, and they congratulated themselves on being such smart chickens. And finally, the rabbi convinced the boy that they might as well sit at the table and not withhold their chicken wisdom from all these little humans. And so the boy and the rabbi sat there at the table talking with everybody else. And in this way, the boy finally was restored to his human self. All thanks to the rabbi.
Thanks, Jordan. We'll get another story next week. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Balak in the book of Numbers, including some of the best words an outsider has ever delivered to our people. In the portion, one of just two in the Torah named after a non-Jew, by the way. See if you can guess the other. 40 years of wandering have passed. The Israelites have finally arrived on the borders of the land of Canaan. They're about to move in, and they seem unstoppable to their opponents. Balak, king of Moab, comes up with a novel plan. He will hire Balaam, a pagan sorcerer, curse the Israelites, which will destroy their chances of defeating his own army and entering his land. Only the scheme doesn't work. Balaam may be a polytheistic prophet. Hard to say that. He is also an honest man, however, who conveys only what God allows him to say. After consulting the Almighty, Balaam agrees to do the deed, but only if God permits him to do so. And so we are given the intriguing spectacle of Balaam, the sorcerer, three times trying to curse the people of Israel, only to find that the words that come out of his mouth are not curses but blessings. The last of these orations is a text that has become the prayer that we use whenever we enter a synagogue. Ma tovu ohalecha Yaakov, how good are your tents, Jacob, your homes, Israel. Somehow, the best laid plans of Israel's biblical enemies go awry, transformed by the hand of God. Perhaps more importantly, the message of this part of Balak is a subtle one. Usually the way it works in life is that we intend to bring blessing, but bring tsoros, trouble, instead. You know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. But if we rely on God's help and inspiration, we may find that even our less than nobly motivated actions can bring blessing in place of curse. It's all a matter of remembering the true source of inspiration and creativity and of blessing, which is God. Here's a little of a classic recording of Ma Tovu, the text from this week's portion of Balak, the words of Balaam, how good are your tents, children of Jacob, your homes, people of Israel, from a composition by the great German Jewish composer Louis Lewandowski. Ma Tovu, a song of welcome on entering a synagogue, and words written by the protagonist of our Torah portion this week, the pagan prophet Balaam. When we come back on Too Jewish in a few moments, we'll get the news of Jews around the world and talk with Bruce Feiler, author of Walking the Bible, about what being a dad really meant to him when he was faced with death, and how he chose to carry on that idea in a unique and amazing way. Find out about it when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The European Union has imposed tough new sanctions on Iran. The measures target, among other areas, Iran's energy sector, including bans on new investment, technical assistance, transfers of technology, equipment, and services related to these areas, particularly related to refining, liquefaction, and liquefied natural gas technology, said a European statement issued in Brussels last week. The sanctions come a week after the UN Security Council broadened existing sanctions against the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is believed to control Iran's nuclear weapons program, and encouraged member nations to interdict and inspect Iranian cargo for banned weapons. The sanctions came a day after the U.S. expanded its own list of prohibited Iranian entities, including a bank and a number of shipping companies. In other news, Israel's cabinet unanimously approved a commission of inquiry into the interception of a Gaza-bound flotilla that left 9 passengers dead and many wounded. 2 foreign observers were named to that commission. During the meeting to approve the independent public commission, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that its establishment will make it clear to the entire world the state of Israel acts according to the law, transparently and with full responsibility. I am convinced the commission's uncovering of the facts will prove that the goals and actions of the state of Israel and the IDF were appropriate defensive actions in accordance with the highest international standards. Back in the United States, American Jewish groups are calling on the U.S. State Department to designate the Turkish Relief Group, main organizer of last month's Gaza mini ship flotilla, as a terrorist organization. In a letter to U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton, the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, said that Insani Yardim Vakfi, the humanitarian relief fund, or IHH, has well-documented ties to Hamas. The ADL has also written to Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, urging his department to add IHH to its lists of terror-sponsoring organizations, which triggers restrictions on business and banking with the U.S. American Jewish Committee also urged the State Department to investigate ties between the IHH and terrorist organizations on the U.S. list of foreign terror groups. Meanwhile, back in Europe, in the country where Hitler was born, Austrian Jews in Vienna reportedly have been facing almost daily harassment since Israel's interception of the Gaza-bound small ship flotilla. Ariel Musikant, president of the Viennese Jewish community, said that members of the Jewish community have been subject to verbal abuse and spitting. He said the violence has been directed at those who are identifiable by their clothes as being Jewish. There so far has been no physical violence. Musikant, who heads the Vienna Israelite community, the body that represents Vienna's Jews, also said his organization filed lawsuits against the organizers of recent anti-Israel demonstrations because anti-Semitic slogans and images were used. The protesters reportedly were mostly Turkish or of Arab origin. Similar reports have been received on increased anti-Semitic activity since the flotilla in France. No surprise. And kosher meat remains under assault in Europe and elsewhere. As part of a proposal to regulate food information, the European Parliament voted to require that meat labels state the method of slaughter. Kosher meat will be labeled as meat from slaughter without stunning, according to the proposal passed last week. The vote was 559 in favor, 54 against. The proposal will need the approval of all 27 member countries of the European Union before it becomes law, after which food businesses will have between 3 and 5 years to comply. Jewish groups believe the decision is discriminatory and will have a negative effect on the kosher food industry. It probably will. Some 70% of each animal killed according to Jewish law is used by the non-kosher market. The requirement to label meat as slaughtered without stunning was singled out in the proposal, while methods like electrocution, shooting, gassing, or clubbing were not mentioned. Interestingly, the proposal comes on the heels of a decision by New Zealand's government to ban kosher slaughter as part of a new animal welfare code mandating that all animals for commercial consumption be stunned prior to slaughter to ensure they are treated humanely and in accordance with good practice and scientific knowledge. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our extraordinary guest this morning, Bruce Feiler, author of Walking the Bible, America's Prophet, and I guess a total of 9 books now.
Oh, who's counting? But yeah, 9 books.
Somebody, your publisher for sure is counting.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm not sure. Authors don't really trust how their publishers count. But the but 4 books in this. So there's Walking the Bible. There was Abraham, Where God Was Born, which is basically the second half of Walking the Bible. Yeah. Then America's Prophet, my book about the influence of Moses in America, and now, I guess to a certain extent, continuing this sort of faith and family theme, the Council of Dads.
You know, your wife Linda plays a prominent role in the book. As we discussed earlier in the show, the Council of Dads came about because you, famous for walking the world, suddenly discovered you had a terrible form of aggressive bone cancer in your femur. The same leg you broke as a kid on your Schwinn in a car accident. Was there any connection?
Well, we don't know. I mean, yes, I think that there probably was, although the problem is that several million people break a bone every year and only 100 adults get this kind of bone cancer. But I was in a car accident when I was 5 in Savannah, Georgia, and broke my left femur. And for 38 years, it was the only medically interesting thing that ever happened to me, and then it cancerifies. And so I think that there is in likelihood a connection, whether the accident caused whether the fracture caused the cancer or whether to a certain extent the cancer caused the fracture because that bone was predisposed to be weak, I don't think we know. But I think that, you know, you mentioned Linda, and I think in a lot of ways, what this experience has turned out to be is an experience of community building. When we had our twins now 5 years ago, we thought it would be all hands on deck with our friends, that everyone would rally around and help us. Instead, it was run the other way. And then when I got sick, we thought it would be run the other way, and instead it was the most transformative, powerful act of friendship that we've ever experienced. And I think that, to me, at its core, that's what the Council of Dads has proven to be. It's not really why I did it, but it's proven to be a way to kind of build a bridge between your family and your friends. Especially parents of young children complain, I'm so busy, I've got my job, I've got my kids, I don't see my friends. This has given us all an excuse to bring our friends much more intimately in our lives. And I think that's one of the, as the book now is making its way into the world, I'm hearing people say, you know, I think about you for a couple of pages when I'm reading the Council of Dads, but then I think about me. Who would be in my council? Who's my oldest friend? And what role would I want them to play? And so that's why I think whether you've experienced loss of any kind or whether you've ever experienced the kind of rallying around of community, if you come on this journey with me, I think you'll be inspired because it really will. You're going to be picking up the phone and calling your oldest friend and calling a long-lost friend and reaching out to these other friends and saying, I want you to be more involved with my kids.
When you asked people, was it an awkward thing? How did it feel?
Awesome. Awesome, awesome, awesome. I mean, I think that one of my pieces of advice about this is reach out to a long-lost friend and tell them what you really think about them, or even to any friend. Sit down with your friends and tell them what they mean. Or name that friend. Use the words. Linda started joking that it was sort of like a proposal, like a wedding proposal, because I planned them all so carefully. I wrote a letter. The Council of Dads opens, as you know, with a letter to the men But I didn't read it. I didn't send it to anybody. I read it in person. And the conversations that ensued were some of the most meaningful I've ever had. And so it was this great thing. I mean, that's one of the things that was so striking about it. And you know, this is a show called Too Jewish, and there was, I have to say, kind of a Jewish idea that emerged from the heart of this by the end. And that is, I mentioned Moses a couple of times. There's a quote on the side of the Liberty Bell: "Proclaim liberty through all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof."
Leviticus 25:10,
and that, you know, Leviticus is the least loved book of the Bible, right? It's like full of filibuster, and nobody really loves it.
Right.
But that passage from the Holiness Code is, as you know far better than I, is one of the most sacred and beautiful expressions of human morality in the entire text. And what it basically says is every seven years you give the land a Sabbath, and every seven sets of 7 years you give the land an extra year. That's the 50th year, and that's the year. And what does the Bible say? Slaves are to be freed, families reunited, you are to be surrounded with the ones you love, you're supposed to take the needy and the hurting into your arms. And that's really what happened to me when I got sick, and what the Council of Dads is really about. That 50th year in the Bible is called the Jubilee year. So my lost year fighting cancer was really my Jubilee year, when I was forced to lay fallow, when I was surrounded by the ones I loved and taken into people's arms. And so I feel like the land, that having done that, and we can let out some of the suspense you set up earlier, I'm now cancer-free, have been cancer-free for over a year, still struggling to regain my ability to walk. But I feel so many ways so rejuvenated by this experience of going through this, being surrounded by the people, and being uplifted in this way. And that's been the great joy of the experience of being sick and of creating the Council of Dads.
What a phenomenal story. I want to talk a little bit about Moses, although I think we could talk about Council of Dads for a long time. It's an extraordinary story, and a powerful experience to read it, let alone to have lived it and created it. You talk about in your book, America's Prophet, Moses as really the true founding father of America. I don't think most people think of him that way, or think of America's founding fathers in that way.
Well, the interesting thing is the founding fathers thought of him that way. On July 4th, 1776, immediately after passing the Declaration, the Continental Congress asked Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, and John Adams to come up with a seal for the new United States. And 6 weeks later, they made their recommendation. The seal should be Moses leading the Israelites across the Red Sea. So that's three of the five drafters of the Declaration, three of the defining faces of the Revolution, and they thought Moses should be the face of the new United States. And what America's Prophet tells the story of how every generation has used the story in the same way. So the pilgrims were inspired to use the story. The founding fathers, the black slaves on the Underground Railroad, generation after generation, obviously Martin Luther King during the Civil Rights Movement, and right up to today, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama have all used this story. Like, you can't understand America without understanding the story. And I really believe that the Exodus story has become America's story, and Moses, our real founding father. I mentioned earlier Moses on the side of the Liberty Bell, the Statue of Liberty, the spikes of light around her head, the tablet in her arms, both of which come from the moment Moses comes down Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments. So at its core level, the story has become so part of the American dream, the Exodus story, that we don't even realize how novel this idea is that Moses could echo in this country 3,200 years after Moses would have lived.
And Moses, of course, another champion walker.
Another champion walker, yes. I've been up and down Mount Sinai a few times, including some with TV cameras, and every time I did, I thought, Moses would have done this in sandals.
And then coming down carrying, you know, stone.
Exactly, carrying whatever.
Twice, he broke them.
So he had to come down again. So twice he makes that, you know. It's like the old Mel Brooks joke of coming down with it. These are the 15 commandments. Oh, oops, the 10 commandments. Voluntarily breaks them when he's upset about the golden calf, and then goes back up and gets a second round.
I love that scene. I want to thank Bruce Feiler, author of The Council of Dads and America's Prophet and many other books, for a great visit here on Too Jewish, and wish him continued success in walking again and teaching us all about what it means. Thanks very much, Bruce.
Always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you so much.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be one of the youngest labor leaders in American history, Amy Dean, author of the cutting-edge book, A New Deal, A Dynamic New Approach to Organized Labor for the 21st Century. Our playout this morning for Father's Day is a reprise, the original version of Oh, Mein Papa, as sung by Eddie Fisher, who recorded it back, in the 1950s. If you remember, Eddie Fisher was the one who Marilyn Monroe converted to Judaism to marry. Oh, no, maybe not. Maybe that was Arthur Miller. Or maybe it was Debbie Reynolds? Anyway, my friends, have a happy Yom Shalava, a joyful Tata's Day, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Oh, my Papa, to me he was so wonderful. Oh, my Papa, to me he was so good. No one could be so gentle and so lovable.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.